Welcome into the 5 o'clock hour of this Wednesday edition of News on the Hill. I am Brighton McConnell. Thank you so much for tuning in. We've got a lot of local news stories to catch you up on, but we begin, though, with some reflection, since today marks 1 year since the first positive case of COVID-19 was identified in North Carolina. Many of our experiences with the coronavirus started that day when a Wake County resident found out they had been exposed during a recent trip. Over the next 365 days, we saw lives change in many ways. Businesses shut down or closed. People stayed at home for a long time, and loved ones were lost to the virus. We've learned many new phrases and terms like social distancing, remote learning, and what a Zoom call is. More than 863,000 North Carolinians have tested positive for the virus since that day, with more than 11,000 dying from its complications and many still striving to fully recover from its effects. It's truly been a year unlike any other in our lifetimes, and yet we have learned a lot and made significant strides since that day. Locally, our leaders have largely protected public health, limiting the spread better than some other areas in the country. Our businesses and schools have learned to adapt. Our academic community has spent hours upon hours researching COVID-19, and it's beginning to pay off. On this 1 year mark since that day, it is also the first day all frontline essential workers in Group 3 are eligible for their COVID-19 vaccine. It comes after hundreds of thousands of North Carolinians have already gotten their doses, which has helped limit spread and prevent deaths. We learned yesterday during a press conference of state leaders the recently approved Johnson & Johnson vaccine will help bring a new element to these vaccination efforts. Secretary of North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services, Dr. Mandy Cohen, spoke a little bit more about what this brings.
A third COVID-19 vaccine means North Carolina can get more people vaccinated sooner and meet our goal to provide equitable access to vaccines in every community across the state. Later this week, as the governor said, we expect to get more than 80,000 doses of Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and we'll be getting 215,000 first doses of the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines, bringing our state's allocation to almost 300,000 first doses for this week. Additionally, we'll have 160,000 second doses arriving. Our state allocation from the federal government is also providing more vaccines through our federal pharmacy program with Walgreens, the FEMA site in Greensboro that the governor discussed, and the federal program with our federally qualified health centers. This is all positive news. While vaccine supplies are still far below what we need to vaccinate everyone, they are improving.
Once again, Dr. Mandy Cohen of the State Health Department speaking there. She also revealed yesterday the state aims to move to Group 4 of vaccination on March 24th. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper shared that he got his vaccine today as part of Group 3. Last Friday, he also loosened some guidelines and capacity limits in place to prevent the spread of COVID-19. The change was one of the first for certain businesses, including bars, seen since last March. 97.9 The Hill's Ava Pukach has more on the perspective of some Chapel Hill bar owners and how they've gotten through this last year.
Chapel Hill nightlife has been quieter since the start of the pandemic. With bars and restaurants operating at limited capacity, business has been slower and more focused towards to-go orders. Some were even closed for almost 1 year to indoor diners. Governor Cooper's initial executive order back in December allowed restaurants and bars to sell mixed drinks to-go. SupDog's owner Brett Oliverio said this was a no-brainer for him.
35 other states had already been doing it since last April safely, and there's been zero increase in DUIs or crime or anything of that nature.
Although mixed drinks to go could bring in an extra couple $1,000s in revenue, Oliverio said his restaurant is still feeling a major impact from fewer customers.
It's a bigger disaster than anyone could possibly imagine. I mean, we are a super high volume, busy restaurant, and you know, we're struggling to make money. You know, unless you are a quick service place or a stop and go pizza place, I mean, just full service independent restaurants have really taken it on the chin. The next few years are going to be really extremely tough for independent restaurants.
While SupDogs is adapting to mixed drinks to go, other restaurants weren't interested in the idea. Christopher Carini is the owner and manager of Linda's Bar and Grill. He said he was concerned about potential repercussions from providing to-go cocktails.
It sounds like it's a really good way for somebody who's really sad to find a way to drink and drive. And I wasn't really into it. I really want to do it, to be honest.
While Linda's will provide to-go drinks if a customer asks, Carini said the restaurant is working towards permanent solutions.
But I'm not going to advertise and go out of my way to make it another product line because I feel like it's going to be a short-lived thing. I don't think it's going to be permanent.
One long-term change at Linda's Bar and Grill is rebranding its down bar as the Understudy. Carini said he hopes the area can be used as a study and hangout location. The new feature is meant to draw in more customers, similar to Linda's incorporating all-day brunch into their menu as another permanent addition. Governor Cooper's recent executive order increases capacity for indoor dining to 30%, allowing restaurants and bars to serve more customers. Nick Stroud, owner of Local 506, The Baxter, and Belltree, said he is a little nervous about allowing patrons indoors, but is happy to not have to rely on weather conditions being optimal for patrons. Stroud's businesses had been relying on to-go orders and outdoor dining only. He said while the 30% capacity is comparable to a slow weekday, it is enough to cover local costs, and he looks forward to welcoming back people into his bars.
This isn't an opportunity to come out and expect things to be normal again. We want you to come out. We want you to support us and support all the other bars in this area and state, but let's not mess it up for everybody.
For more information on Governor Cooper's executive orders impacting the Chapel Hill area, visit chapelboro.com. For 97.9 The Hill, I'm Ava Pukach.
Time now for a look at sports around our community, and we've got a couple of women's program from UNC to update you on. UNC senior attacker Jamie Ortega was selected Tuesday as the ACC Women's Lacrosse Co-Offensive Player of the Year, just 2 days after she broke the all-time UNC goal-scoring record. Ortega shares the weekly honor with Boston College attacker Charlotte North, and she earned it following a week in which she scored 8 goals, dished out 4 assists, and, as I said, broke the previous UNC goal record of 198 total goals. Ortega has racked up 16 goals so far in the 2021 season, which is good enough to put her at the top of the ACC leaderboard in scoring, and there are a lot more games on the schedule for her to pad her new school record. Next up on the schedule for the top-ranked Tar Heels women lacrosse program is a home game against Boston College. That is scheduled for Saturday at 11 a.m. As the UNC women's basketball team prepares for their ACC tournament matchup tomorrow, 2 Tar Heel freshmen were announced today as members of the All-ACC Academic Team. Deja Kelly and Alyssa Utsby earned the honor, which recognizes both academic and athletic success during the 2020 and 2021 season. The Tar Heels were among 41 ACC players honored, with Louisville's Dana Evans chosen as the winner of the Kay Yao Award, which is awarded to the conference's Scholar Athlete of the Year. Kelly and Utsby are both expected to be in action for Carolina's matchup against Wake Forest tomorrow in their opening game of the ACC tournament. You'll be able to listen to it right here on 97.9 The Hill. Our coverage is set to begin at 11:30 in the morning. Thanks so much for tuning into this Wednesday edition of News on the Hill. Our next story is on sexual education. While North Carolina schools are required to teach it, the curriculum is not required to be comprehensive or even updated to discuss topics like consent or sexual orientation. But one Chapel Hill nonprofit is working to change that, at least locally. 97.9 The Hill's Elle Karras has this report.
The Compass Center for Women and Families provides career and financial education, domestic violence crisis and prevention programs, assistance with legal resources, and youth health programs. The center currently provides 2 school-based youth empowerment programs in Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools, one of which is Teens Climb High. Teens Climb High offers a medically accurate and inclusive sexual health education to 9th grade students. Leslie Massica is a sexuality educator and the program coordinator for the center's Teens Climb High program. She said the Compass Center works closely with CHCCS health teachers to provide comprehensive sexuality education in 2 weeks.
You know, health teachers, the training that they get on sexuality education varies. We found in this school district that our health teachers were more than willing to have the Compass Center come in and provide this content. But we do it all in line with their health program that they already have in their classrooms.
CHCCS health teachers currently follow a set of standards called Healthful Living. Under Healthful Living curriculum, teachers must include instruction on abstinence, pregnancy prevention, STDs, and HIV. Curriculum must also teach that a faithful, monogamous, and heterosexual marriage is the best lifelong means of avoiding STDs. Massicott said not only is this current curriculum outdated, but there are also no standards related to sexual orientation or gender identity. To fill in those gaps, the Compass Center works to incorporate inclusion of LGBTQ terms, topics, and concerns throughout their educational programming.
And so what that looks like in the schools is that myself and my fellow teachers through the Compass Center, we have been able to alter our language to make sure that we're speaking using gender-neutral language and person-first language. And we, at the beginning of every class, offer students an opportunity to provide a name for themselves. They create name tags, and they're also able to provide their pronouns if they're interested.
The current material the Compass Center uses in its Teens Climb High program is called Making Proud Choices, which is from 1998. While their funder, the Teen Pregnancy Prevention Initiative, requires the Compass Center to use materials from the 90s, Massicott said they do their best to still be inclusive while being confined to the curriculum's dated core standards.
We basically are trying to toe the line of making sure that we're following the standards and also making sure that we're not marginalizing any of our LGBTQ students.
According to CIKUS, a national organization that advocates for everyone's right to accurate and comprehensive sexuality information, only 58% of North Carolina's high schools taught students about sexual orientation or gender identity in a required health course. Additionally, only 40% of the state's secondary schools provided students with curricula that included HIV, STD, or pregnancy prevention information relevant to LGBTQ youth.
You know, like, I would love for the standards to be able to include our LGBTQ students more. You know, I think it's going to take time for a state like North Carolina to start, you know, changing standards but I mean, we'll just have to see. We do what we can within the standards that we have.
For 97.9 The Hill, I'm Elle Karras.
Congratulations are in order to Jim Woodall, who is the longtime district attorney for the Orange and Chatham County District. He officially announced earlier this week he's going to retire at the end of his term in 2022. Woodall has served 31 years in the district attorney's office and described his time there as an honor. Assistant District Attorney Jeff Neiman has already announced his plans to run for the position in 2022. He spoke with our own Aaron Keck about that this morning, and you can find that full conversation by going to chapelboro.com. All you have to do is scroll down our homepage to the This Morning with Aaron Keck section. As I mentioned at the very top of the hour, today is the one-year mark since the first positive case of COVID-19 was identified in North Carolina. Joining me in the studio is Assistant News Director Elle Karras, who has some information about where the state has gone since then. I mean, March 3rd, Elle, I think, is seen by some people as the start. Other people, it might have been further down the road when the ACC basketball tournament got canceled, when the governor put out his first stay-at-home order. There are a lot of different periods for folks, but this is definitely the one that marked pretty immediately for us, at least in the newsroom, and for many others in the community, something is up.
Yeah, well, we might not have seen the dramatic impact of, you know, initial stay-at-home orders and business closures until, say, later in the month in March. March 3rd was the day when we were talking about this even a few months ago, where we had just finished up local election season here. And then the next day we got that news that there was a potential, well, actually a confirmed case in North Carolina. And it has just been a wild year since then. And I did have a chance to sit in on a panel discussion today with a bunch of our top infectious disease experts and UNC experts in their field to kind of just recap. Oh gosh, it was so much to cover, just what has happened in this past year and kind of where we stand right now. And you know, some of it even seems really basic, like you and I were having this discussion earlier in the newsroom today about when the pandemic first started, it was all a mad rush to get PPE and to even just get COVID-19 tests available. And then to see where we are now, we're moving to vaccination efforts. It seems like a wild journey.
Yeah, it started with being able to just do a handful of tests a day. And now in our community, there are so many different ways that you can go get tested. I also remember the very first day that UNC held drive up tests, mm-hmm. and it was a huge deal that people could go check out whether they had this or not. And I mean, that was even after we had stayed in our homes. Most of us had stayed in our homes for a very long time. Some essential workers and obviously first responders had to continue being out there. But for the most part, it was just this very strange period last March, probably a couple weeks away from where we are now from being a year ago. But it was, everybody was staying at home. Everybody was worried to go outside. You gave people a lot of space, but we didn't know about masks and whether masks were effective yet. That didn't come around until about May.
You and I were talking about that, how, May or even very early June, where it didn't really become super commonplace yet. And we look back at that now, kind of like, because it feels like we've been living in our masks for forever
now. Exactly.
And kind of talking about UNC testing, even just to get a gauge on how far we've come, you know, on this panel discussion that I sat in on, Dr. Melissa Miller, who runs UNC's clinical microbiology labs, she said, you know, at the beginning, when they first rushed to get some testing available, they were only able to conduct 100 to 120 tests per day. And now, you know, assuming they get all the supplies that they need, they're able to conduct 2,500 tests a day. And it, I mean, that in itself is crazy.
It is pretty impressive. And that is on top of course, vaccine efforts. Mm-hmm. A big part of it, especially in our community where we have UNC in our backyard doing a whole lot of research, at one point being named the top university in the world conducting COVID-19 research. There's been so much work done on the academic front into going into researching what this virus is, how it came to be, how it spreads so quickly, and what we can do to best combat it, both in the short term and then in the long term with the vaccine. And now we've reached a point, as we began today, with all of group three becoming eligible a week early because our vaccine supplies have been a little bit more steady. I mean, that's already improved drastically since where we were in December, when it seemed like we were just initially rolling out vaccines.
Not even just December, but in February, when we were, I didn't think we were ever going to move out of group two with the 65 and plus. So the fact that group three is completely open today and now group four is scheduled for March 24th, I mean, that's just a pretty rapid speed along. I know that the state government is saying that they've seen a 135% increase since January in vaccine allocation. And like you mentioned, with UNC Health just in our backyard, I mean, we also have one of the largest vaccination clinics here at the Friday Center.
Absolutely.
And today, again, at this panel, UNC Health is saying at their 15 clinics across the state, they've administered almost 200,000 doses. And that includes 3,500 just here in the Friday Center.
And it sounds like a lot.
Sorry, 35,000 here at the Friday Center.
It sounds like a lot. It is certainly a lot. But then you put that into the context of North Carolina has already surpassed 2.5 million doses administered. They are really cranking along. And it is worth noting, with that amount to go in terms of 2.5 million administered, but there's still a long way to go in vaccination efforts. There's still a long way to go in terms of putting this pandemic fully behind us. You know, very many people, both in our community and across the state, passed away from this virus, and we're not out of the woods yet. But looking back on it a year later, we definitely feel like we're in a different spot than we were 6 months ago, 3 months ago, even 1 month ago, as you said.
And that is important to note, that it is just last week that we did pass 500,000 deaths from COVID-19 here in the U.S. And from a lot of the infectious disease experts that we've been talking to, they're just saying that, you know, the speed at which vaccination rollout happens is just going to make all the difference in how many more people are going to die from this virus before we can reach some level of herd immunity, which disease experts right now are saying is about 85% who have either been vaccinated or gotten that natural immunity from already contracting virus.
There's a lot to continue discussing on this front, a lot to take from that UNC Health panel that we'll look forward to learning more about in the next day or so. And Alcaris, thanks so much for coming in to discuss this with me as we do continue to grapple with the pandemic, both good and bad, during this month of March.